Welcome to One Bills Light, your no speed limit version of our daily show, One Bills Live, where we slice it up faster than a Michelin star chef. This week, we dive into how the QB landscape has changed in the AFC East post-draft. Steve is quizzed on the history of first-round quarterbacks hitting the field, and we talk to Bills GM Brandon Bean about his most recent draft class and what might be needed in the structure of a Josh Allen contract extension. Can you dig it?
And it's Steve Tasker who has been all over the field.
Kind of unique. He was kind of a dual role player for you.
Steve.
A balloon.
Steve. A blimp. We're not even in the stratosphere of normalcy. Welcome to One Bills Light. Thanks for joining us. Chris Brown here. Steve Tasker there. And we want to begin with a dynamic that came. That's nice. You're waving to everybody.
I do.
Really nice of you.
I do that.
We want to begin with a dynamic that came out of the 2021 NFL draft that will have a lasting impact, or at least could have a lasting impact, on the AFC East. Last year, the Miami Dolphins drafted Tua Tagovailoa fifth overall, and he played some and with a varying degree of success. This year, the Jets drafted Zach Wilson, and the Patriots drafted Mac Jones in the top 15 picks. So Buffalo's Josh Allen, the most experienced quarterback at age 24 in the division. He'll turn 25 in about 2 weeks. So how will the two newest quarterbacks impact this division in 2021, if at all, Steve?
I think it's going to be difficult. It always is for a young quarterback. We've seen it lately, however, when guys get on the field first, they have some success. Justin Herbert in San Diego, Joe Burrow in Cincinnati, albeit in a shortened season because of injury. We've seen some guys have some early success. Pat Mahomes in his second year was very good. Other guys have done that. So in recent years, the trend in the league is to fit an offense around what your young quarterback can do and let him grow from there. And as he grows, so does your offense and your menu of plays. Look for that to happen in both New York and in New England with the Patriots. So, and also in Miami. So, yes, they're going to have a little bit better success, but they're still on an uphill climb because Buffalo's got a guy that was runner-up in the MVP voting a year ago, and it looks like he's got the leg up on all those places.
I do have to say it was pretty noteworthy how the Jets approached the draft, because even after they drafted Wilson, they kept pouring it on the offensive side of the ball. Elijah Vera Tucker, followed by the slot receiver, Elijah Moore. They didn't address their defense, which is desperate for talent, until day three almost in the draft. And they have a defensive head coach in Robert Saleh. That was very telling to me that they surrounded him with as much as they could. And to a certain extent, the Patriots did the same thing, more so in free agency maybe than in the draft per se. You know, getting the receivers, Kendrick Bourne and Nelson Agholor, and then the two tight ends, Henry and Jonnu Smith. So it looks like both teams did what they could to surround whoever the quarterback was in New England. It was Cam Newton at the time, and Zach Wilson. So this build around the quarterback top priority on the list seems to follow a lot of what the Bills have done the last couple of years with Josh. So it'll be interesting to see if it works as well for them as it did for the Bills and Josh Allen.
And with defensive head coaches, and let's face it, Bill Belichick started out as a defensive coach, Sean McDermott, Robert Saleh, and Brian Flores.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't thought of that.
It's four defensive coordinators who elevated to the head coaching slot in the division. You got to think there's a little bit of confidence in those head coaches that, listen, we can work with the defense. We can scheme it up and give ourselves a chance to be competitive on that side of the ball, even without loading it up with top-flight talent out of the draft. So there's a little bit of that going on, I would think. But nevertheless as well, the Bills have, for the current state of affairs and the point in history we're at in the NFL, the Bills have set the mark on how to develop a quarterback. Everybody's looking at Josh Allen and saying, why not us?
Do you believe Zach Wilson or Mac Jones have a better chance of putting up a more productive rookie season than Tua did for the Dolphins last year in terms of production first and then wins and losses second?
wins and losses are tough. They won 10 games in Miami last year. He got a little bit of help and relief from the bullpen and Ryan Fitzpatrick. We all know and love him, and he did something. He won one game outright off the bench in Vegas.
Yeah, against the Raiders.
And he also did some helped in some other games that Tua began that he didn't finish. So there's that. But 10 wins is 10 wins. It's a three-game improvement for the Patriots, 7-9 to what it would be 7-11 or 7-10 now with a 17-game schedule. It's a big jump. The Jets, they can go nowhere but up. And I think with if they can get some consistency with Zach Wilson, find out what he can do.
And he's going to play from the jump.
And he's going to play from right out of the gate. And their offensive line is better than Miami's offensive line was a year ago. Mekhi Becton and Vera Tucker give them a basis for an offensive line going forward that may not change on that side of the ball for, you know, 10 years with those two guys.
And finally, does Tua have a better season this year than he did last year? Again, another team that did what they could to surround him with more firepower. Will Fuller there now, and then Jaylen Waddle, the first-round pick, as we know. And then they even got a tackle in round two in Liam Eichenberg, who presumably is going to play right tackle with Austin Jackson, their first-round pick last year at left tackle.
Yeah, they've got some guys. They'll be better around him. But he's going to have to make plays, and ultimately he's going to have to stand in the pocket and push the ball down the field and complete passes. That's the way the league is structured. I've said it time and time again. Ultimately in the NFL, if you want to advance, you got to have a guy that can win from the pocket. Athleticism and all that aside, we saw what happened to Pat Mahomes. The team that won the Super Bowl this year had a quarterback that can't run.
Yeah.
So ultimately, when you get to the deepest part of the schedule and in the season in the playoffs, you got to have a guy that can make throws from the pocket. We have yet to see that consistently from Tua.
One thing that I'm interested to see, assuming Mac Jones, Zach Wilson, and Tua are all playing in the division in time here, none of these guys are 6'3". Jones is like 6'2 and a half. Wilson's like 6'2 and change. And Tua is 6 feet even. And I think about the condor that is now at defensive end for the Bills, Greg Rousseau, just putting his hands up and causing problems for guys like that, especially if you're looking to throw to the flat or, you know, somewhere on some short out route and he's right in your face, man. I'm wondering if the Bills are going to have their way with batting some passes down with those three quarterbacks going forward. It's just something that kind of rang in my head. I know it's probably a minor thing. You're probably talking like 2-3 batted passes a game at most.
That's 2 or 3 third downs possibly.
Yeah,
and
they're off the field.
It's the same story with Epineza on the other side. Last year's second round draft.
I mean, he's no shorty either.
He's got length. He's 6'5 plus and can get his arms up. Bam Johnson, same thing.
Yeah.
He's a tall, high-cut guy who can get their hands up. The Bills obviously look for some traits, and they're starting to fill that roster out with guys who fit those traits, and it's becoming evident that it's going to cause some problems in certain ways.
And I just like the thought of getting tall, long guys that can bat passes down, because more and more the passing game is moving to getting it out so fast that it's almost rendering the power of getting sacks powerless in a way. Not powerless, but it reduces the effectiveness of pass rushers getting home because the ball is coming out so fast. I don't know if these young quarterbacks are going to do that just because of their lack of experience. But as they get older and the passes come out faster, getting sacks becomes that much harder. So if you can knock passes down, you're one down ahead of the offense because you're rendering that play ineffective.
It's a chess match that goes on with tactics and the way teams think about their offense. Offenses are starting to help their quarterback and their offensive line's pass protection by calling plays that call for the ball to get out. They're scheming plays up. They're running cluster formations where, you know, the guys will flurry, you know, explode out of a tight set with three guys standing next to each other. They all go in different direction. One or the other of them turns around, pops open, the ball's out.
Yeah.
It's really difficult to defend, and it causes problems. It's a way to help your offensive pass protection by only having to protect for a second and a half rather than 2.5 seconds. So all of that stuff goes into the mix, and it's one thing that offensive coordinators are doing to combat the fact that defenses spend a lot of time trying to get to the passer.
Yeah. All right, Steve. So this week's numbers game plays off this discussion a little bit. SI.com's Albert Breer recently put out a handy reference for rookie first-round quarterbacks that tracks how soon they get on the field to make their first NFL start. So, Steve, since 2000, the year 2000, okay, there have been 60 quarterbacks drafted in round one. How many of them do you believe started in the first NFL game for which they dressed? 60 quarterbacks in the last 20 years drafted in round one. How many started their first NFL game that they dressed for?
Boy, first round.
And I'll help you out. When you give me a number, I'll say higher or lower.
It's got to be at like 8 of 10 or 9 of 10.
Well, we've got 60 total. So how many of them?
54 would be 9 of 10. I'll say 51.
It's lower. That made their first game was their first NFL start. So
45.
Lower.
Really?
Way lower.
Really?
Yes.
25.
Lower again.
First game. All right. 10.
Higher.
Okay. 15.
A little bit higher.
16. 17. 18.
18. Tom is killing you with that
Tom
buzzer.
Is killing me with that
18
buzzer. Hammering
of the 60 quarterbacks.
Really? That surprises
started their
me.
First NFL game. We anticipate that will happen for Trevor Lawrence and Zach Wilson.
Right.
Probably not Trey Lance. Maybe Justin Fields. Probably
Mac
not Mac
nah.
Jones.
Not with Cam.
Unless Cam's throwing bounce passes in training camp. Like he did during the season. Yeah, I. The most recent was obviously Joe Burrow last year.
Right.
Kyler Justin. Murray in 2019. Sam Darnold for the Jets in 2018. They're going to hit the reset button. Zach Wilson. Carson Wentz. Jameis Winston. Marcus Mariota. E.J. Manuel.
Yeah.
Kevin Cobb
it.
Had a concussion in the third preseason game, and he was out of commission, never played for the Bills.
Again, yeah.
And actually had to end his career. So, yeah. The 2012 class was probably the most impressive. The four quarterbacks that started their first NFL game, Andrew Luck, Robert Griffin III, Ryan Tannehill, and Brandon Weeden.
Cleveland. The illustrious Cleveland.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, that's amazing. I thought it was going to be way high. Obviously thought it was going to
be
way
okay.
higher.
So second question. How many of these 60 first-round quarterbacks do you believe did not start at all in their first NFL season? So you know there
60?
Are 8. You know there are 18 that started in their first NFL game. So subtract that from the number right out the gate.
Right.
Next part is, how many do you believe did not start a game at all
the other,
in their
the
rookie
other
season since 2000?
Didn't start at all. I like
in their well. You know, Aaron Rodgers is in that group.
Right, Aaron. Mahomes did. He
right
started
at the end of the
right
regular
the
season.
Three. I don't even know who they are.
It's a little higher.
Is it?
A little higher. Not significantly, but a little higher, yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's got to be like five.
A little higher than that.
Really? Six.
It's eight.
Eight?
Eight did not start as a rookie. So, yeah, you're talking, let's see. We'll start from the most recent guys. And I'll tell you right now, there is no the last quarterback drafted in round one.
It didn't start at all.
Who did not start in their first season was Jake Locker in 2011. 17th game. First game of his second season.
Who was he with?
No. Tennessee drafted him, right? Didn't Tennessee draft him?
Yeah, he
made it. I think it was Tennessee.
Wow.
And it went up in flames very quickly. Then you have to go back. I mean, really, this is a trend from, like, the previous decade, Steve. There's nobody from 2012 on that did not make a start in their first NFL season. So they get them on the field, man.
Yeah, that's – and I get it, too. I mean, like, Mahomes was the last game of the season. They had Alex Smith, former first pick of the draft,
yeah.
and they were moving on from him. He was an old, even then he was a little bit older, and they were in the playoffs or whatever, and they said, you know, let's give this guy a start. And then, you know, Aaron Rodgers, I mean, it's deja vu all over again. You know, the old Yogi Berra saying, now he's being replaced by number
49th game for Aaron Rodgers.
And I didn't think about it, but that would have been the guy. Jordan Love didn't start at all.
Yeah.
It's easy to see why that list is really short.
Yeah. Jordan Love, actually, you're right. Jordan Love is the only guy in this current decade that did not start in any of his first 16 games.
Even Josh. He was on
Rodgers.
The field week two.
First start week two.
And
got in the game in week one.
Right. He finished the game in week one, like the whole second half.
So here's the last numbers game question with regard to the first round quarterbacks. What do you think is the average number of games that this pool of quarterbacks hit the field for their first start? So on average, when did they make their first start?
20,
game number what?
The 60 quarterbacks we're talking about.
The 60 quarterbacks. Like, they got on the field by what game?
Rodgers is like
50 games. Well, he hurts the average.
Like, it's like 50 games for him, right?
He hurts the average, but he's in the vast minority.
Right, exactly. But there's a lot of guys that were like first game outs, 18 of them that were playing in the first year. I say the first month, the fourth game. Four.
It's 7.78 games, so it's just under the eighth game of the season.
All right, they don't even make it half a game.
Which is what makes how soon before Trey Lance, Justin Fields, and Mac Jones make their first start. We know Zach Wilson and Trevor Lawrence are starting right out of the gate.
Right.
But we're probably looking somewhere before midseason.
Yeah.
Based on these numbers guys.
Like week four. Because you get out of the gates and four games is like, okay, where we sit? How are we looking?
Yeah.
And if you're 3-1, it's like, no, we'll stick with what we're doing.
Yeah, we'll stick with Jimmy G.
If it's 2-2 and you lost the last two by landslides, like, all right, you may give them another game, that kind of thing, right? Then if it's 1-3 and you lost the last three or you won the last one and the others were close losses, you start to reevaluate. But you can see, you get to four games, it's like, all right, it's on the table now.
Now it's a possibility.
Right.
Although the Dolphins last year, they won 3 in a row, improved to 4-3 with Fitz, and then benched him and put Tua in week 8.
Brian Flores, I got a lot of respect for him. But
he zigs when everybody thinks he's going to zag.
There's certain times when I'm like, what are you doing here? Like the Fitz benching, I get. Now, I'll say this too. He's not – Fitz, you're back in.
Yeah, he wasn't afraid.
He was not afraid to do that. And also, he was releasing guys. You know, they cleared their roster, all of that. So it's worth watching, but in the first half of the season, all these young quarterbacks are getting on the field.
Yeah. So it was an interesting conversation. I'm glad we had it. Time now for our featured interview of the week. It's Bills GM Brandon Bean, who addresses trading down for the first time and why, what might be needed in the crafting of a Josh Allen contract extension and what he might still be looking for on the free agent market. Here's Brandon. Brandon, congrats on another good draft class. This is kind of the capper on your calendar year in terms of all the work that you and your staff put in. So I'm sure you're breathing considerably easier that now, although the work is never done, is it?
No, it's we're always looking, and now's the time where you – teams are still making adjustments to their roster, some based on maybe a guy they've got a high cap number for, and they drafted someone high that they didn't want to release them till they saw what they got in the draft, and now they're comfortable moving on. So, yeah, I think over the next 4 or 5 weeks, there'll still be some movement, and we'll definitely be scouring, the waiver wire to see what comes available, if there's a guy that we think could compete to start or just be a back end depth piece for us.
Which side of that coin are you on? Are there guys on your roster you got to move on from because of the finances, or you're talking to them, or are you still out there shopping in the veteran free agent market?
I'm in the shopping market, Steve.
Right.
I got a small bank account though.
Yeah.
Right? So
you're in the clearance aisle, right?
yeah. I'm not at the Mercedes Benz dealership.
Yeah,
I can
right.
tell you that.
There you go.
Hey, I know a guy.
I heard you did.
Right. Yeah. I get that, but let's talk a little bit about that. You guys were pretty disciplined in your board. You were a little surprised. You took two defensive linemen, then two offensive linemen. It's obvious that you weren't like positional shopping. You were player shopping. And now you're not really in that same constraint because you got the whole market to look into. What are your thoughts now about where you head next?
Yeah, I mean, we did follow the board, Steve. And like I said, you'd love to say, hey, here's six or seven positions. We're going to check them all off. But It just doesn't, I mean, it can work that way, but that's not how I believe it should be done. And so we stuck to the board, and now we'll just, like I said, we'll continue to look and see what's out there. And we want competition at every position. We think we've added that prior to the draft, and then obviously the players that we added this past weekend. So we want to make it hard as heck to be on that 53. And I've just found that the successful teams that I've been on, when you were struggling to pick that 53-man roster, that was usually a team that was tough for others to deal with.
Brandon, we should congratulate you on zagging when everybody wanted to predict you to zig with respect to trading up, finally trading down in a draft to buck the trend, shall we say. But I thought your reasoning behind it was very interesting on day three, because you talked about trying to add picks where you could, knowing that potentially the undrafted free agent market might be more difficult for you because your roster is so strong and deep. And it might make some people more reluctant to sign with you guys, knowing how hard it would be to make this roster. So maybe just walk us through that line of thinking and when it really came into focus. Was it strictly a day three thing, or were you even considering that on day two?
We were considering it all points. I mean, there were, we thought there was good depth through the early rounds. We probably had our most players in the third round on our board, and so we did think there was some guys in the middle of this draft that could really come in, and if not be a starter, be a contributor and a guy that could grow into a starting role in time, maybe in a future year. But as we got later in the draft, Chris, it really came down to some conversations we had with agents about players that, hey, if he doesn't get drafted, would he consider coming here? And a lot of those conversations were, well, we're gonna have to see, like, I gotta find the best spot for him. And certain positions, we got some guys that we think can come in and compete. Some others we were gonna strike out. And so we just decided to, honestly talked about even trading back and getting another pick, but couldn't find the right situation, or we liked the guy that was on the board. So honestly, we were just trying to get as many guys, however we could do it, with a late draft pick or recruiting them as a free agent, that can come in here, compete for a 53, and if not make the 53, at least be a guy you'd be excited to have on your practice squad. I mean, right, with the rules now in practice squad, being able to elevate two players a week, it's very important to have as strong of a practice squad as you can, with injuries and things like that.
What was the moment in this year's draft where you felt the most anxious about being in the right spot, or maybe having to move, or when was the most desperate or unsettled time in your draft room, during which of the 3 days and at what point?
Yeah, I mean, it was, the fourth round was tough. Like I said, I had, when we got to the third, I was hoping that, as I told the media, we had a deal in place when we took Boogie Basham, because I just didn't think he was going to be there. And if he wasn't there, we were going to trade back. And we had what we thought was a solid deal for both teams, and for us to go back and acquire an extra pick. And I was excited about either one. I'm going, okay, if we get Basham, that's my first choice. But if not, we've got a good plan in place here that we can add what I think will be value. So then we get to the third round pick, and we just, we had a really good value on Spencer, and same thing, if he was there, we were going to take him. And but part of me, then after we took him, I was like, man, it still would have been great if I could have found a way to add someone early in the fourth. There were some guys coming off in that round that we had, third round grades on, and some of them high third round grades, but it just, we were finally paying our sins for the Diggs trade and got that done. And once we got to the fifth and had those two, it allowed us to take a player and then add some late picks there.
Well, before we go any further, let me absolve you of your sins for the Diggs trade. You're totally forgiven.
Yeah, I think he gets a pass.
I love draft picks. Yes. It's so hard. But no, that was definitely worth it.
Brandon, one thing that kind of came out of this draft, after we kind of looked a little deeper into each of the players, there was an astounding amount of player connections between the guys you drafted and players currently on your roster, whether it was the fact that Boogie Basham and AJ Epenesa were acquaintances, you know, Tommy Doyle's first start in college at left tackle was against AJ when they played each other. You've got DeMar and Dane Jackson, who are not only former teammates at Pitt, but they grew up in the same neighborhood. Marquez was roommates with Ed Oliver, was Tre'Davious White's younger brother's best friend. I mean, some of these were uncanny, but my question to you is, did you take advantage of some of those connections with these players to kind of do some extra drill down type background work with some of those connections that you had?
Not really. You know, we definitely knew most of those connections before it started. I didn't know that Ed had roomed with Marquez Stevenson. I was unaware of that, but we knew that, you know, he knew Tre'Davious's brother. Didn't know if he really knew Trey or not, but came from the same neighborhood. So it's funny, he had two connections. And then, yeah, you're right. We knew about AJ and Boogie playing AAU basketball together. And it's fun when those stories work out. You know, especially for rookie players versus guys that are already on our roster. But, you know, we go into character a lot. And so we definitely made sure each of these guys was a fit and that would come in here. And wherever they are now as a college player, they all have ceilings, some higher than others. But, you know, that's important for us. Is this guy going to do what it takes to reach that ceiling? And we feel like this class that – very confident that pretty much all these guys are going to come in here and be pros and really ascend, you know, as time goes on. Some will not have to play right away. Some will, and we'll see how it goes when they get in here.
Well, as this roster fills out and you get deeper into the off season, what do you know about what that's going to look like? We had a brief conversation before you came on. Juwan James, the right tackle for the Broncos, popped his Achilles working out by himself because, you know, there's all this stuff about opting out and all of that. What about the voluntary nature of the workouts coming in? When's that going to start? What are you and Sean anticipate the Buffalo Bills offseason to look like, and when's it going to start?
Yeah, I mean, we're still in phase one, and I think most of our guys are choosing to work out like a lot of the league, you know, last year remotely. And you know, our guys have done a great job in the meeting rooms, and they've, you know, that's still all voluntary. And, you know, they've been working with Eric Ciano on the workout plan. We would love for them to be here. We do have guys here, and the guys that are here are getting great attention from our staff. They're getting more attention than they even normally would because you only have so few here. But we're hoping, you know, that we get into phase two, Steve, that more will start to show up as we can now. The rules will change that you can start to get on the grass with them. It's limited rules, but and then we'd love to have, you know, we'd love to have everybody, you know, by phase three because you can't replace those reps, but it is voluntary in nature and, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. That's a CBA deal. And, you know, we still don't know who and how many are going to show up, but our doors are open and we'll keep, you know, hoping that one by one they trickle in here, you know, the rest of May and hopefully by June.
Talking to Bills GM Brandon Bean, and Brandon, I know you guys picked up the fifth year options on both Tremaine and Josh, and you've been very upfront, I think, publicly about the fact that the organization and Josh and you're all on the same page. You want to get an extension done in due course. The question here is, I don't even want to call it a stumbling block. The thing that's out there that is unknown is what the cap's going to look like next year. And there's still some uncertainty behind that. How much of an issue is that in your guys' budgeting and figuring everything out? Because this is not a simple extension. This is a you know, a franchise quarterback we're talking about. I know I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but how imperative is it to have at least a firm grasp as to what that number is going to be to get things done with Josh?
Yeah, I mean, we'll probably, you know, until we get into the fall and see how many people are in these seats, you know, are they half full, three quarters full, what it is, you know, it should definitely be better than this past year. But that could affect whether the number's 192 or 200. And so they're still going to be, we're probably going to have to hopefully find a structure if we're able to reach some type of agreement where there's some flexibility in next season's cap number for Josh. And that's where, you know, hopefully his representatives will work with us, understanding the hurdle, the unknown hurdle that we're facing right now. And again, I mentioned it on the radio the other day of this is hard picking up two guys at $36 million because the when we drafted them, the CBA was different. And these guys both got increases of what we anticipated their fifth year number to be based on making Pro Bowls. And, you know, we're proud of them. We love them doing that. But fitting two in when the cap goes down has made it really hard for us to navigate that. So it definitely will be important in the structure. It won't be, it won't mess with the APY or the guarantee, Chris, but it will be important how we structure these first few years to make sure we can, you know, as this cap works its way back to where it should be, hopefully by 23, 24.
Just on the horizon, we just, it was just reported by Aaron Bessiker that baseball's reopening, and the governor of New York State says that vaccinated people can have normal capacity and normal seating at stadiums. So if they're doing that
for baseball,
So if they're doing that in New York State here in May, you got to think by September, you're going to be able to sell out the home games and have it more back to normal, which will help the cap. And, you know, it's all, it all goes into the pot for what you've got to get done financially with your players. But that's, it's going to be a much different landscape coming into this next season than it was during the pandemic. You've got to have real optimistic hopes about that.
Yeah, I'm excited that where we're at now from a fan standpoint. You know, a year ago, talking to you guys, there was uncertainty whether there'd be a season, you know, and that the league did a heck of a job, the players, everybody, to pull off the 256 plus the playoffs. So it's exciting, you know, just shoot, the 6,700 fans we had for those playoff games was exciting. So now we're talking about if you're vaccinated, you know, the potential that you can not have to social distance at games, that's huge. And hopefully, you know, fortunately, we still have until August for preseason and then September till it really counts. So I hope we have every seat filled here.
I realize, Brandon, you guys are probably still waiting for some undrafted free agent contracts to come back before everybody's signed, sealed, and delivered. But is your number, you know, based on what you had said about, you know, how it might be a little more difficult to recruit guys, do you have your numbers where you want them for the most part in terms of that portion of your roster here, knowing rookie camp's about a week away?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're probably, you know, these guys will have to come in and take physicals. We've got some workouts lined up next week. We'll probably be, by the end of the mini camp, I'd say 84 to 87, depending on these guys. And we'll be able to go up to 91 because of the Christian Wade exception. One of the things we're doing research on is, you know, last year the league made us and the union to reduce our rosters down to 80 to start camp instead of 90. There's been some uncertainty whether, you know, it could be a different number than 90. Is it 85? Is it 80? So we're going to try and monitor that before we push the roster up to 90 as well.
Yeah, because I saw there was a write-up out of New England that the Patriots really aren't participating much at all in signing undrafted rookie free agents right away. So it seems like they're kind of holding their water on that too. It's very that's a very interesting development. You got to it seems like they're changing stuff on you guys all the time, and you got to pivot like at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, it's well, I mean, a lot of teams wasted money signing some of these, you know, these young players after the draft last year, and it's unfortunate because there were some players that we thought had we been able to keep them around. I mean, fortunately, like Antonio Williams, we had to cut him right away. To get down and just from a number standpoint, but fortunately we were able to get him back, but there were some that we weren't able to get back. And, you know, obviously selfishly we wanted all 90, but I felt really bad for some of these kids that you're talking 10 a club that 320 players, I guarantee you there's some players in there that had they been able to go to camp would have made a roster. And it's just, I hope for the league that we keep it at 90. It's very important. And this year we're going to be playing preseason games.
Right.
And last year we weren't doing that. Injuries will happen. We know that when you're playing those games. So going with 80 this year could be very problematic because all of a sudden you get a run on injuries at a position. You've got to either injury settle and replace them, or you've got to play starters longer. So I hope that they come to a resolution at some point and we get it up to 90, but we'll see how that goes.
What do you anticipate the protocols to be going through there? Are you guys going to be testing every day? Like, you, I mean, it was like getting up and brushing your teeth in the morning. You were getting tested. I mean, it was amazing. You're right. I think the biggest win for the NFL last year was getting all 256 games. And I've said it, I think it was the most underrated accomplishment in all of professional sports was the league getting it all in. But how much of that's going to carry over to this year, and how tough is it going to be just to get up and rolling again?
Yeah, I mean, the early indications are that if you're vaccinated, and that means fully vaccinated, means you've been 2 weeks since your second shot, that you're going to have to probably test once a week. But if you're not, then you'd have to test every day like we did last year. Still unsure about the masking, how that will go. I think there's going to be some incentives to, if you have X number of percent of your players and staff vaccinated, you can live normal, let's just call it, back to the old days. If you don't, it's going to look more like last year. Social distant meetings, encourage as many to be virtual, mask in the building, maybe even mask on the sideline. You know, a lot of that still to be determined, but I hope that, you know, if those are the rules, that we'll be able to get enough people vaccinated and not have to deal with all the headaches from a year
ago. So if you're one player away from the ratio from living normal or having everybody to be tested, do you just cut a guy that's not vaccinated?
Wow.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I would, because it'd be an advantage, honestly.
Absolutely.
Steve. I mean,
yeah.
We're laughing, but, you know, these meetings were not as productive as before because we had, I mean, you guys saw it in the field house. We had 3 and 4 meetings going on, and sometimes you're talking over each other, but it was the only way to pull it off and be socially distant. So it would be an advantage to cut a player and fall under that umbrella.
Last one for me, and I know this is a little bit out off the radar. It's in the back burner right now. But the 2022 draft class, as compared to this one was by all accounts was small. It was like 600 guys coming out, kind of eligible. Next year, you're gonna have like 9,000 guys in the draft pool. So those draft picks seem to me would be a little bit more valuable. But what are your thoughts about next year's draft? What that's gonna look like in the wake of what we've seen over the last 18 months?
Yeah, I mean, I still feel like, and this is early. I mean, I don't know a lot about this class, to be honest with you, other than some guys that we were looking at that we thought may come out and that went back. But the guys that were getting back grades top 3-4 rounds, they came out this year. So I don't think that number is going to be different. I think the third day draft picks, though, those 5th, 6th, 7th, and free agents, I think there's going to be a lot in that pool, which, listen, you can still find very good players. You look at it every year. I think I saw a stat the other day that in the conference championship games, the 4 teams had 28 starters from the 5th through 7th round, you know, something like that, which was as many or more than any other round. So it's just, I do think it'll be a heavier volume of players we've got to work through and get situated. I don't know if the first 2 days will get moved a lot.
Brandon, as always, thanks for the time. We hope the weather improves for you so you can get some well-deserved time off and hit him straight out there on the tracks.
I know. I got to catch Steve. I know he's well ahead of me right now.
You owe me money. All right. Thanks, man.
I always do.
Thanks, Brandon. Okay, Steve, it's time for our one burning question.
Give it to me.
I think we can say definitively that the most successful rookie quarterbacks from the 2020 class were Justin Herbert and Joe Burrow before he suffered his ACL knee injury. Which quarterbacks from the 2021 class do we believe will have the kind of success that those two had as rookies here in 2022?
For me, my opinion, zero.
None of them.
Zero. Now,
Because of the teams they're playing for?
One of them may emerge and be offensive rookie of the year because you're going to take every snap, Zach Wilson or, you know, Mac Jones or Trey Lance. I probably not, but maybe if an injury happens, they could emerge and do that. But they are not going to have the year that Justin Herbert had last year.
Yeah.
There is just no way. That guy was off the hook,
had one of the greatest rookie...
Over 30 touchdown passes.
Greatest rookie seasons for a quarterback of all time. Now, it could be a trend where we start seeing that a little more, but I don't believe in the situations these guys got drafted into that any of them will have the kind of success that Justin Herbert had last year, or Joe Burrow, for that matter, before he was injured.
I wonder about Justin Fields a little bit. There are some pieces in place there for him to have success, and you know that that front office is under pressure to win games and go forward with a new guy, and I think they're going to be anxious to get him on the field sooner rather than later, but is that good for him is what remains to be seen. Right. Same can be said for Trey Lance, who, you know, 17 starts at the FCS level. Now it's in the NFL. I don't know. And then you look at Trevor Lawrence, Zach Wilson. They're not really on teams that are ready to compete yet, so they're going to be getting the tar knocked out of them. And then you go to Mac Jones, and it's kind of unclear as to when he might get on the field. Right. Although if he does...
Trevor Lawrence, if he stays healthy and on his feet, yeah, he's going to have he'll be successful, more successful than the Jaguars have been. But, you know, you look at all these teams. Chicago, Justin Fields, maybe he was one of the top two or three quarterbacks in this draft for a lot of people, even though he was off of radar for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
In the great words of Jim McMahon, former Chicago Bears quarterback, Chicago's where quarterbacks go to die. that's a tough place to win as a quarterback.
Yeah.
Jacksonville, Trevor Lawrence has got a chance to be good. It all depends on how Urban Meyer and his coaching staff adjust to the NFL game coming into it.
Right.
What they can give Trevor Lawrence to make him successful and the tools around him. Trevor Lawrence, that team may be a little bit more successful, but I don't know that Trevor Lawrence is going to be able to put together a season the way those guys did last year.
He might be productive individually,
yes,
but they still may not win enough games. That's the rub there with Jacksonville and probably a couple of the other teams on that
list. It's going to be fun to watch, though.
It will be, and they'll be front and center every single week. And if Aaron Rodgers doesn't play in Green Bay, that could be different. The landscape of the NFC North for Justin Fields could be dramatically different. That'll do it for this edition of One Bills Light. Don't forget to subscribe on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you know when our next episode is released. And remember, when there isn't enough time for One Bills Live, there's always enough time for One Bills Life. For Steve Tasker, I'm Chris Brown. We'll see you next week, everybody.